This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones of From the Depths of DVD Hell. And joining me of course from Guerrilla Ramblings and Eastern Kicks is my co-host Stephen.
Hello, thanks for having me again.
Tonight's show we are going to be looking at Peking Opera Blues. Stephen is going to be taking us on a jaunt around Asian cinema as he shares with us his key leading ladies of Asian cinema, as well as the fact that we're also going to be looking at some of the aspects of Asian cinema which have obviously been holding our attention since the last show. First off, though, most noteworthy, we have to obviously say a big thank you to ThatMomentIn.com, who have, in fact, picked up this show, and we are now a proud member of the ThatMomentIn.com podcast network. So you will now be able to find our complete back catalogue, as well as all new episodes at ThatMomentIn.com. Other than that, the feeds will all stay the same, so you'll still be able to any of your subscriptions you've got set up through Podomatic and iTunes will still remain the same, so you won't have to worry about that, but you also have the option to subscribe through thatmomentin.com as well. But we're both very excited to be part of thatmomentin.com and certainly one of the founding members of their podcast network. If you obviously want to check out the network, make sure you do. It's at thatmomentin.com. At the moment, with us ourselves, you've got Cinema Recall, which is hosted by The Vern, or The Vern's Video Vortex, which is looking at key films and directors. They've just done an episode, as of the time of recording, on Luc Besson and The Fifth Element. So some really great shows coming up there, and we hope to be joined by some more shows in the network in the coming months. But obviously back to our show this evening. We're obviously, since the last show, there's been a lot of exciting developments in the world of Asian cinema. Most noteworthy is the announcement from Tom Mez that he is going to be releasing a new book called Unchained Melody, the films of Miko Keiji. And this, both myself and Stephen were very excited about, because we're both fans of Tom Mez's writing, because he obviously owns the site Midnight Eye. He's done a number of commentaries, as well as a number of great books, including Iron Man, The Cinema, Shinja, Tsukumoto, as well as Agitator, The Cinema of Takashi Miike, and The Midnight Guy, Midnight Eye, A Guide to New Japanese Film as well. But Stephen, I mean, I'm right in saying you're a fan as well of Tom Mez?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, along with people like Bay Logan, Tom Mez is one of the leading lights in appreciating and contributing to their love of Asian cinema around the world. You're right. You know, his work on Takashi Miike is probably required reading, and any time he contributes to a DVD or to a website, it's always a good thing. So I'm really looking forward to this new book.
Yeah, I mean, I was hoping, I think like a lot of people were, that his next book would be a follow-up to Agitator, because obviously with Agitator he essentially covers the early and outlaw period for Takashi Miike's work. But obviously with Miike churning out as many films as he does, normally around 7 or 8 films a year, it's a bit of a job to obviously keep up with his book. So you would have expected by now, seeing as that book was released back in 2006, that we would have seen a follow-up volume, and all we've seen as such was his coffee table book Reagitator, a decade of writing on Takashi Miike, which perhaps wasn't the volume we wanted on the subject. So I know I'm excited for this new book, which is obviously available to pre-order both through Arrow Books. Arrow Film have gone into the book industry now, much like Fab Press, and have started producing books on cult cinema, this obviously being the second book to come out through their publishing line. The book is also available through Amazon. It was supposed to be out at the end of last month, but it has now been pushed to the 11th of September. So if you currently don't have the funds to hand for it, then you do have a little more time to obviously get the funds together and get that pre-ordered. So, but I mean, obviously since the last book, I mean, what's been holding your attention, Stephen, obviously in the world of Asian cinema?
Well, in the world of Asian cinema, there's been a couple of things. So, and you'll be very glad to know, I've actually made a start on my Dead or Alive trilogy. And so I've now finally, after all these years, finally seen, talking of Takashi Mike, the first Dead or Alive film, and had my mind blown, both by the quite amazing opening sequence, which is, at the moment, to my mind, one of Mikey's greatest moments as a film director, and that ending. I'm not going to spoil it, but wow, what a crazy thing that encapsulates everything we love about Mikey, I guess.
Oh, definitely. I don't know if you felt the same, but when I watch Dead or Alive, I feel like it's the Asian version of Heat.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. But that opening sequence, the energy in it, and the fact that everything that you see in that opening 5, 6, 7 minutes,
yeah,
is absolutely relevant to the plot moving forward. I had to go back and watch it again after finishing the film, and that rarely happens to me. You know, normally I'd like, you know, leave it a couple of days or something like that, but I literally just press play again because I was blown away. Because quite often Mikey can be guilty of not being a huge stylist or with the camera. Quite a lot of his films are can be accused of being a bit point and shoot, which comes from his his V-cinema days, comes from the sheer number of films he sometimes makes of a year. So you don't often get the style with it, but that's just amazing. So I'll watch the next two in the next couple of months probably, but I need a bit of a rest after that.
Yeah, I mean Dead or Alive is a real high point of his outlaw period of filmmaking. I mean, the fact that he has his two lead actors counting down to obviously the chaos that he's going to unleash, and yes, it has some rather extreme moments, which let's not say we're just not going to spoil, and just for questions of taste on this particular podcast, but I mean, it's got Riki Takeuchi and Sho Ekawa as your two leads. You've got like this Yakuza boss going up against this determined detective Joyama, who is like determined to take him down, like regardless of like how it affects their family, his family life and anything else. It's just like these two characters that are both in like the top of their field, and they're determined that one of them's going to take the other down. And in the middle of this, you've obviously got this gang war between the triads and the Yakuza happening in the background, and it's all these different elements that make it such an exciting film. And I think when we talk about the outlaw period, I think between this and Rainy Dog, those are the two that I always cite as being the entry point into this era for Miike's filmmaking. And I think perhaps to an extent it's overshadowed his films, the fact that it's meant that a lot of his fans who sort of joined him sort of like in the late 90s when Asian cinema was getting this second boom felt kind of disappointed when he did like Three Extremes and started moving away from the extreme material and started doing lighter stuff such as Ace Attorney, for example, or Yataman.
Which is a shame, actually, because I really like those light affair. I think he's got I think he's one of the few directors who can take, let's say, manga adaptations or game adaptations. Ace Attorney is a Game Boy game adaptation. Let's not forget about that. And he makes it into something fun, utterly respectful of its source material, but you don't need to know about it at the same time. I mean, Yataman, he takes sort of Japanese Saturday morning live action kids fair and turns it into something interesting and something, you know, it's bright and colorful in the same way, a little subversive at other times as well. So I do sometimes think some of his more modern work is possibly underappreciated.
Cool. Was there anything else? Was it just
well, there was actually. So I also got hold of that there was a film 8 years ago, a film came out called Crush and Blush by a female Korean director called Lee Kyung-mi. And she hasn't done anything for 8 years. Crush and Blush is a lovely little comedy drama that's a little bit dark. Then last year, I guess it was, now she came out with a political thriller called The Truth Beneath, although I think she actually made it a couple of years earlier. And it stars Son Ye-jim, who's one of those faces of Korean cinema. She made her debut in her most well-known role is in a film called The Classic, which is by the director of My Sassy Girl and things like that. But she's now pretty much sort of alternates between dramas and big summer blockbusters that are fairly rubbish, really. But this is just amazing. It starts off as a political thriller with very prescient stuff going on about the modern situation in South Korean politics, and turns into something else completely. Again, I don't want to spoil it. I know it's been shown at festivals and things like that. I don't know if it will get a release over here. I doubt it, but it's a really special film that starts as one thing, the political thriller, and ends up into a dissection of a mother's love for her child, and it's quite wonderful.
Great. For myself, it's obviously been a very exciting month since the last recording. Most excitingly is the fact that the channel Viceland have decided that they're going to pick up the anime gauntlet and have started adding anime to their schedule. So they started off with the classic Cowboy Bebop, as well as Eureka 7. They have since added to this roster of anime titles by adding Tokyo Ghoul, as well as Samurai Champloo to the roster. And it's really nice to see Viceland picking up and doing these midnight screenings of anime, because especially for myself, it very much feels like a throwback to the old days of like Channel 4, when they used to do the late night showings of things like Devilman, and they used to show late night anime. And it's great the fact that we obviously have this now being replicated, and having a fairly mainstream channel obviously giving anime a place outside of obviously the streaming services that you obviously have through like Netflix and Amazon and Crunchyroll. So to have it actually back on the screen and having titles such as Cowboy Bebop leading the sort of charge here has been absolutely fantastic. And Cowboy Bebop is such a great entry title if you're new to anime. It's so great the fact that they've chosen to do it, because it's so fast paced, it's funny, there's lots of action, and it's got a jazz soundtrack to it as well, which makes it really accessible. And the fact that they've been showing the dub rather than the sub again makes it a little less daunting for those obviously not too familiar with the anime sourcing. And obviously from there they can go on to try something a little more challenging, maybe something like Attack on Titan, which it's still holding my attention. I've got like 8 more episodes to go, and I'm still at the point where I don't want it to end. The second season has been just as enjoyable as the first, and I am determined that I will get Stephen hooked on anime one way or another by the time we finish this show. So,
yeah, you really are. Although, I mean, I guess the most important thing is that it's actually got a place, and that something is showing it, because it just seems to be a huge hole, because manga and anime are incredibly popular. You know, you go to any bookshop, go to any video store, they have huge sections for this media, the sort of the Japanese entertainment media. But it just seems to be an easy win for someone like Netflix or someone like that to put something up there, and it just doesn't seem to happen. So it's good to know that Viceland have taken up the opportunity.
Yeah, and it's really sort of tying into the model that they've been doing. I mean, they've been picking up a lot of niche sort of indie comedies, such as like Son of Zorn, Nirvana the Band, The Show, and this sort of fits perfectly into the model that they've created for themselves on that channel. I mean, they've had sort of a lot of documentaries based on social subgroups and sort of society in general, and they've been sort of combining it with these sort of cult items. And obviously this new anime block is it's been a really great addition to it, and I've been really happy to obviously see them expand upon it and not just make it like this passing fling like we often see with like Film 4 when they do the Shaw Brothers season. We get like 5 movies and then we get about 7 months before we get another season. So I'm always happy to see another aspect of Asian culture and cinema obviously being given a decent slot and a decent presence on to the mainstream audience can obviously access. So, but obviously tonight we are talking about Peking Opera Blues. Now, this is a film obviously noteworthy for its three leading ladies. One of my favorite aspects of Asian cinema is the fact that we have so many films with strong female leads, and this film is another classic example of a heroic trio of kick-ass ladies. I mean, in this case, we got Bridget, Bridget Lin leading up the action. She's obviously joined by Shuri Chung and Sally Yip. And this obviously got us thinking, I mean, who are the key ladies of Asian cinema? So we've, Stephen's obviously been compiling his list of who we would consider his top ladies of Asian cinema. So, I mean, Stephen, who should we be looking at when we think of these key ladies of Asian cinema?
Okay, well, I'll just say we could do podcasts on this for the next 200 years and I could pick a different list every time. And I suspect this is something we may come back to. But what I've done, I've picked six or seven names from various ages, various eras of Asian cinema, of cinema, and from various nationalities. Shall I just go through my list?
Yep,
and
yep.
tell you why, and then you can argue and tell me anyone I've missed out.
Okay.
So what I think I'll start with Bridget Lin, as she's in today's film. She is an icon. She's one of the icons of Asian cinema from her early days as a young beauty in Taiwanese romance and period films to her integral part in the golden age of Hong Kong cinema, the 80s and the early 90s, right up until her final performance, which we talked about last time in Chungking Express. She's a visually striking woman. Don't just think she's famous for cross-dressing roles like in Swordsman 2 and to a degree tonight's film. She's a very versatile actress, but you'll always know she's there. If you want to look at some key texts, you can go back to her performance in Dream of the Red Chamber, which is a classic Chinese novel, a Taiwanese version of that she was in. She was also in Jackie Chan's Police Story, Peking Opera Blues, which we're talking about tonight, Swordsman 2, and of course she was the original bride with the white hair.
Yeah, I mean, that was obviously my first entry point into the cinema of Bridget Lin. I mean, when you obviously had a bride with white hair, and I think it was like Verbico, it was like some extreme label that got hold of those titles, because they also brought out the first Baby Kite in Peril, well, the combination film, Shogun Assassin, and they had Bride with White Hair 1 and 2 on the same label. So those were absolutely fantastic introductions to this character, and obviously I didn't think at the time she would... It was just all the sort of films that she appeared in. But yeah, as we mentioned already, she's appeared in some classy fare as well. Not to mention, I mean, Chungking Express, which we looked at in the previous episode, where she's there with... She's got that iconic image of the film. She's there with the blonde wig, and she's essentially been playing the Asian Greta Garbo. But no, it's always exciting to see Bridget Lin. If I see she's in a film, then I always have to check it out, regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. She's up there on the pedestal of her own, certainly in sort of Chinese cinema. I'll add another name, similar name, another Taiwanese actress who possibly is more famous for her work in Hong Kong, which would be Joey Wong, or Joey Wang. Sometimes you'll find it written because it's the same name in Mandarin and Cantonese. She's one of the great beauties of Asian cinema, most famous for playing a willowy ghost. Let's just think about A Chinese Ghost Story, the whole trilogy, but obviously the first film she's most famous for. But you'll also see her popping up in places like Jackie Chan's City Hunter, which is a crazy manga inspired film where she stars in, and also King Hu's Painted Skin, where she plays one of the beauties there. She's probably not as well known outside Asia as, say, Bridget Lin might be. But if you check out, there's a very excellent Taiwanese film by Giddens Co called You're the Apple of My Eye, which came out a few years ago. She's the face on all the posters of the young boys back in 1980s Taiwan. She's the poster girl of Taiwan. So, yeah, and a face you'll see around a lot, especially when you look at the sort of golden age of Hong Kong cinema.
Yeah, there's definitely some key tiles there. I mean, certainly Chinese Ghost Story 2 is probably my favourite of the trilogy. I think it's a lot more fun, a lot more fantasy elements. And City Hunter is probably one of the most underrated of the Jackie Chan films, especially of the golden period of Jackie Chan movies. And I enjoy it just for the fact it has a homage to Street Fighter 2 in it, where you have Jackie Chan dressed as Chun-Li taking on a guy dressed as Ken. And they do like the spinning bear kick and the hurricane kick, and it's so absolutely stupid, but it's just a lot of fun at the same time, even though it is essentially just an anime or manga adaptation. No, I think City Hunter is very underrated, and again, she's very good in it as well.
Okay, so I'm 2 for 2 so far. I'm pretty certain I'm going to have a success with this one when I talk about Maggie Cheung Manyok. There is another Maggie Cheung who's very famous in Hong Kong TV, which sometimes gets confusing. So she started off as a beauty queen. She's a runner-up in Miss Hong Kong. She was a Miss World semi-finalist. But she became an actress of, I would say, of the highest standing. You can go and check out her early fun roles, again, in Police Story, alongside Bridget Lin and Jackie Chan. I know another favourite of yours is Heroic Trio, which is another huge amount of fun, which I suspect we might come back to on this podcast at a future date, and New Dragon Gate Inn. And then she grows as an actress phenomenally into probably, you want to look at something like Center Stage or In the Mood for Love, Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love, which is probably one of the most iconic visuals of an Asian actress you'll ever find. And then she married a French film director, Oliver Assayas, and she made the rather interesting and Irma Vep, and then the award-winning Clean, which I think was the last thing she ever did formally. But you know, she's worked in both within Hong Kong cinema, French cinema, and English language cinema, and she's, to my mind, probably the finest Chinese actress ever.
I'm not going to disagree with you. Maggie Cheung is fantastic. Whether you're looking at like those early Hong Kong years when she's doing things like Drag from Russia, Police Story 3, Supercop, Heroic Trio especially, which obviously plays up her London upbringing by having a whistling London bridges falling down as she plays the bounty hunter character of the trio. And let's not forget, Heroic Trio also saw her sign alongside future Bond girl at the time, Michelle Yeoh, who plays the Invisible Girl, and Nita Mew, who plays the Wonder Woman. Not the Wonder Woman of DC, but a different Wonder Woman. Then we obviously get into the later years, and as you said, I mean, she starts doing things like In the Mood for Love, which I can only urge anyone who likes Asian cinema to definitely look at. And even though it's a film which is held in such high regard, it's still a very accessible film. It's not the highbrow, complex film that the amount of praise it receives would have you believe it is. And I think the less said about her deleted scene in Glorious Bastards, really, the better, really, because I think that's kind of still a sore point for many people.
It certainly is for me. Now, I could now keep going on in Chinese actresses, and we could talk about the mainland's four Dan actresses, Zhu Jingli, Zhu Zhan, Zhao Wei, and Zhang Jihe, who people have various knowledge of, but I think we might talk about them another time. And what I thought I would do is just have a little look at some other territories. So if we go to Japan, one of my favourites is a quirky little actress called Yuri Ueno. Now, Yuri Ueno isn't going to be in any films you can probably get over here, maybe one or two, but she's very different, very quirky, has that sort of pixie girl look about her, but she also does some utterly mental stuff. Sort of her key works would be something like Turtles Are Surprisingly Fast Swimmers, the best time machine time travel movie ever, which no one's ever seen, called Summer Time Machine Blues, and her debut part in the brilliant Swing Girls, which I highly recommend anyone to find, will make you fall in love with her.
Yep. another fine choice. I mean, I've only obviously seen him in Tales of Surprisingly Fast Swimmers, which is available through Third Window Films at the moment over here in the UK. I'm not sure what the release label is for abroad, but no, I mean, she's definitely an actress I want to see more of. Swing Girls is certainly on my list of films, but then again, it's quite an extensive list of films I still have to watch, so you obviously have to excuse me the fact that I've not seen it, but I can't help but feel that we will be looking at Swing Girls in a future episode, so keep an eye out for that one.
Oh, we certainly will be. Okay, and so I'm gonna skip over Japan now and go, my final two choices are going to come from South Korea. And we haven't actually talked about any South Korean films really yet on this podcast. That's something we'll sort out fairly soon. So first off, we'll talk about Jeon Do-yeon. She's sort of a proper actress. She's not one that comes from, unfortunately, in South Korea, the career path often starts in pop music, then into dramas, and then maybe you'll get onto screen. And frankly, talent is disposable. So whilst there are some big names, and one of them, again, I'll talk about as my second choice from South Korea, you don't get a lot of actresses, really. Certainly ones that are over 30. Now, Jeon is something different. She's South Korea's finest actress, or modern-day actress, period. Her debut, I think, was in a film called The Contact, which is a classic sort of romantic melodrama of Korean cinema. Her breakout role was probably The Harmonium in My Memory, which is another fantastic film. Her signature role would be in Secret Sunshine, where she became the first Asian actress to win Best Actress at Cannes. But she's so versatile. She can do light fare, such as the fun thriller Countdown, and risque stuff, like the remake of The Housemaid. She will be a seal of quality for any Korean film you pick up with her name in. She'll raise even the most average material, but usually she picks really good material.
Yeah, I think we've discussed off air about The Housemaid before, and the fact that the original is a film really worth checking out. I know it's one of Martin Scorsese's favourite films, and frustratingly, it's been one of those films which will turn up occasionally on TV or it turn up on a streaming service like Mubai, and it's still not available anywhere to get hold of. And it's still frustrating because it is such a great little potballer. But the remake I've yet to see, and I'm kind of in two minds, because obviously when it comes to remakes, it's always a bit hit and miss whether they're going to work or not, whether they're going to be able to be too referential to the source material. But I mean, have you seen the remake? I mean, what do you say is the verdict on that one?
I actually think it's a really good remake. It's a much more sexualized film, which is actually quite rare in Korean cinema. They can still be fairly prudish around sex. You know, obviously, things like The Handmaiden that have come out recently, which are a bit more in your face about it, but it's still quite rare. It's a sexual film. The basic story remains the same, but it's much more, obviously it's in colour, which is the main difference. but it's a modern retelling of it, but it's a perfectly valid remake. I'm not the sort of person who is always the biggest fan of remakes for remake's sakes, but if you update it and you add a bit of modernity to it, it's worthwhile. And she's brilliant in it, and it's well worth watching.
Cool.
Okay, and my final choice for tonight, but like I say, I suspect we'll be coming back here again, is Jun Ji-hyun. You might know her as Gianna Jun. She's had a bit of an English name. Now, forget about anything she's done in Western cinema, like The Forgettable Blood, The Last Vampire, and the really disappointing Snowflower and The Secret Fam. But think about her in two parts of her career. Her movies were at the forefront of Hallyu, which the Korean wave, this period where Korean entertainment, music, television shows and movies suddenly became popular, not only in Asia but in North America, in Europe. And if I tell you her film, two of her films were My Sassy Girl and Il Mare, you'll know that, you know, She's the key face of that movement. Nowadays, she tends to appear in big summer blockbusters like The Thieves, The Berlin File, and Assassination. But she's managed to go back to her roots and star in a Korean drama called My Love from Another Star, which was absolute sensation 2 or 3 years ago across Asia. If you met anyone Asian from not just Korea, but Japan, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, they will have been watching My Love from Another Star. So even now she's in her mid to late 30s, she's still box office gold. And she's a unique looking lady, but she's actually a really good actress as well.
Cool. Definitely covered the wide spectrum there of Asian leading ladies. Certainly the only one that I would always want to add to that list would just be Michelle Yeoh, just because I feel that Michelle Yeoh is really one of the most fantastic leading ladies of Asian cinema. The fact that she was doing her own stunt work, when you look at films such as like Supercop 3, where she's Police Story 3, where she does the motorcycle jump onto the train, and the fact that we have films from her such as Magnificent Warriors before she took her retirement when she got married, only to for the marriage to eventually fail, much to the benefit of Asian cinema fans, as it meant that she obviously then came back as an actress and started doing things such as like Heroic Trio, Executioners, before moving on to doing Western cinema such as like Tomorrow Never Dies, and even like moving more away from doing like the Hong Kong action cinema and doing more dramatic roles. And we see her turning up now in surprising places like Luc Besson's The Lady, and sci-fi fare like Sunshine. So it's always interesting to see where Michelle Yeoh's going to turn up next, but I'm always happy when she does.
She even makes an end credit scene in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, right? I mean, yeah, she's obviously on the bubbling under list. I didn't want to miss her out, so thank you for bringing her up. I mean, she's an absolute icon as well. From Malaysia originally, another one that I think went down the Miss World route to start with, but she's far more than that. And like you say, she's both a genuine action star, which is probably I didn't cover so much in this list, and a serious actress as well, and a Bond girl. So what more could you want?
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break there, and when we return, we're going to be looking at our featured film this evening, Peking Opera Blues.
Listen to The Lair of the Unwanted on iTunes, and you can hear me, Jason Soto, use the F word.
French?
No.
Fudge?
Sorta, but no.
Frank?
No.
Fridge?
No.
Faruka Balk?
What? No.
Farfid Nugan?
Jeez, no.
Alright, what F word could you possibly be talking about?
I'm talking about
In the Lair of the Unwanted, covering the movies you don't want to see and more, on iTunes.
And we're back. We're now obviously looking at our feature film for this evening, which is 1986 Peking Opera Blues, directed by Su Hawk. Now, this is a film which, as we mentioned already, it stars a trio of fantastic Asian leading ladies, and heading up the cast, we obviously have the iconic Bridget Lin. She's joined by Sally Yu, as well as Sheree Chung. And the film itself, it's set in 1911, when the Chinese Revolution overthrew the monarchy and established a republic. And in this chaos that's happening, the general's daughter, who played by Bridget Lin, is trying to steal some important documents from her father's safe in order to help out the local guerrillas who are fighting for the Republic. And her thrown into her exploits between these two characters here, because we obviously have Bridget Lin, who's plays Cho Yan. She's the daughter of General Chow, played by Kenneth Tusang. And she's working with the daughter of the local Chinese opera played by Sayyet. And through into this, we've also got the gold digging musician Hong here, played by Shuri Sheng, who finds herself caught up in the Peking Opera while trying to track down a box of jewelry that she's been attempting to steal. And this is a very unique film in the fact that it combines dramas, elements of like romance and screwball comedy and slapstick and Hong Kong style action. There's so many different elements that are thrown into this melting pot, and yet somehow it strangely works. This is a film that I ended up having to watch twice. I think by the time we've watched this, I've seen it about three times now, and it only rewards further viewing. So if you don't get it the first time, and certainly if it sounds a little confusing when we're trying to explain it, then we do apologize. But it is a film that rewards repeated viewing. But I mean, Stephen, this is obviously your choice. I mean, why is it about Peking Opera Blues that made it such an essential recommendation on your part?
Okay, so for me, Peking Opera Blues embodies a period of cinema. It's 1986, Hong Kong film by Choi Hark, as you say, at the peak of his powers. It's the fast pace, the complex storyline, the strong female characters, as you say. There's a little bit of history. There's a little bit of stuff about the Nat Lim, for God's sake. But it's a crazy romp. I mean, it doesn't slow down. Every short, fast, snappy, it moves very quickly. It's all Chinese opera side, but then there's just, it just embodies a time and a place, both in what it's just on the screen and when it's made, that for me, it's almost like a gateway piece of cinema. Yeah, if you get this, you're going to get filmed in the next sort of 10 years after this in Hong Kong cinema, because it's got that energy of Hong Kong cinema during the golden age.
Yeah, it's, I mean, this is very much a comment on the director, because he's always been such a fiercely independent director in his unique filmmaking style. I mean, it's easy to understand why people like Quentin Tarantino rave about his film so much. I mean, Tarantino has openly expressed his love of this film, even going as far to recommend it as a companion piece to Chungking Express when he did the Rolling Thunder Pictures release of that film. For myself, this film is, the fact it's headed up by Bridget Lin, who once again is playing a very masculine sort of role. She's got the very manly sort of short haircut here that we see in this film. And she receives great support by Sally Ye, who is obviously highlights the sexism within the Chinese opera system, in the fact that women weren't allowed to do Chinese opera. All the roles were played by men, and it was seen as a great shame on your opera house if the fact that you had a woman playing a role in your opera. And it's kind of funny, in the fact that we have all these female characters and they're more masculine than the men, who are very feminine throughout the film. I mean, we obviously have the lead actor of this opera troupe, who is, I don't know, he's camp. I don't know if he was supposed to be gay or not, but at one point he gets a marriage proposal and it's unsure whether the person proposing to him knows he's actually a man or not. It's one of the many fascinating elements of this film.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the PC brigade might get a little upset at some of the campiness of some of the male actors. there's a little chorus of quite clearly homosexual men, but it's all done in great fun. But of course, you have this wonderful juxtaposition. You have Bridget Lin's character, who dresses very masculine. She's very much of the modern age. She's about the introduction of foreign culture into this sort of pre-revolutionary, post-revolutionary 1910-ish China. You know, she looks like a man, she dresses like a man, but she's very feminine, especially when she has a pajama party a bit later on in the film. but at the same time, you have, as you say, the character in the Chinese opera where only men can play women. In fact, only men are allowed to watch, if I remember rightly. But she, you know, she wants nothing more than to be a woman playing a woman. And then of course we have the final character, the sort of the gold digger, who's played by She's a bit more like it's a bit more of a commentary on some of the sort of obsession with material wealth that maybe some Chinese wouldn't be accused of. So it's this lovely mix up of different looks at female power and lack of power in Chinese society, both then and now.
Yeah, and the actual storyline of this film, we have these different elements floating around. We've obviously got the rebellion who are secretly trying to overthrow this military regime that are coming in. We obviously have that classic trait of Hong Kong cinema where we are introduced to one bad guy only for said bad guy to be replaced in the third act by supposedly the even more evil bad guy, which we get happening once again here. And this obviously being one of those rare occasions where we have a perfectly fine bad guy and he's replaced by a bad guy who's pretty much on the same level, I would say. I don't say there's any, he's not any more evil or villainous than the original villain that we had. I mean, he truly does have a fantastic dispatch sequence, which if I had seen it prior to obviously doing our Deadpool draft over on the MBDS showcase, that I probably would have listed it as being one of my top five movie deaths of all time. It's this absolutely fantastic way that he's dispatched, where he's basically shot more times than I think I've seen anyone shot on film before. He's turned into a human clay pigeon in the finale, which is, I think, it's worth watching alone for. The end finale of the film, where we obviously have our heroes and they're almost flying for the air in this Wuxia style chase sequence around the opera house, is absolutely fantastic end to this film. But it's ironic, really, that the elements of the film I didn't actually like were the actual Chinese opera parts, which I found a little caterwauly in places, shall we say.
Oh, that's a shame, but I can understand why. Although I don't think there's too much Chinese opera stuff really going on here. The other thing I like you say, it starts with bad guy number one. Bad guy number two takes over. Bad guy number two, dispatch. Bad guy number one, and actually, there's a third bad guy, isn't there? There's the head of the ticketing operation, who's also, but they're all men, and they're all fairly mustachioed fellows, aren't they?
Yes.
Facial hair. It reminded me a lot of that film we watched a couple of episodes ago, Tears of the Black Tiger, in terms of the look and the feel and certainly the hirsuteness of the men. So there's a bit of a match there, and I do wonder if Tears of the Black Tiger was using this as a little bit of a model for it. But even then, even now, with someone like the General Chow character, Kenneth Tang's character, who is Bridget Lin's father in this, there's a bit of tenderness between them, isn't there? I mean, he's not a twirly moustache villain. I mean, he acts like it to start with, but then there's a tenderness between the father and the daughter. You know, he may be a traitor to China because he's basically helping foreign interests eventually take over, but she doesn't want her father hurt, even though she knows the right thing to do is to protect her country. There's these sort of subtleties to it that I think rise it above the normal fare, because sometimes these things can get a bit jingoistic, can't they? I think Peking Opera Blues is far more complicated than that.
Oh, definitely so. I mean, the fact that we have so many elements floating around in this film, I mean, perhaps we could drop the gold digger character. But at the same time, she is kind of fun, and the fact that she joins this harem of women that the general has, and how she just constantly works into the plot, because she's never really a member of any particular one group at any one time. She sort of finds herself thrown from one situation to the next, and it's all through circumstance that she finds herself caught up in this ongoing plot that's running throughout the film. And yeah, it's
yeah no I love her character because her character is shameless, and she's but you know, they don't paint her. There's no point in the film where she really becomes a hero. It's all by circumstance, and it's all, even up to the last minute, it's led to a desire to have gold bars, to, you know, and to better herself through financial reward to get out of the world that she's in. You know, she's playing music for peanuts. Yeah, I think that's when she's introduced. And so you have some sympathy with her. She's got this opportunity to make some money. She's thrown into this kind of revolutionary activity. You're quite right. She's never really part of it. And she gets out of, at the end, you know, she's not changed to a better person of it. But she's a huge amount of fun. Where Bridget Lin and Cherry Chung probably have much more straightforward and serious storylines, without the Shang Hung character, I think it just wouldn't be as much fun.
No, we need her for the to make up our ass kicking trio.
Indeed, we do.
Because I think that's the thing with Hong Kong cinema; it's always better when you have a trio of ass kicking ladies than just the one. But
well, you could have seven or eight, but three will do.
Yeah, exactly. Now, in terms of the action scenes that we have throughout the film, I mean, we have a little bit of Hong Kong martial arts action in there. We have a lot of heroic gunplay, which really made some of the higher points of this film. The fact that this is gunplay as done by whoever directed the A-Team, because people are firing round after round. No one's reloading. No one is getting hit. But you've got all these bullets ricocheting everywhere, and we've got characters doing these like Wuxia style moves where they're like jumping from banner to banner, and it's just so, I think it's some of my favorite moments of the film is when we're engaged in a heated shootout with someone. So
yeah, although I will say, I mean, Hark is usually quite a good director of action. This one is a little bit cheaty, isn't it? Because we don't have any of the great action stars in this film. I don't think anyone in this film is famous for being a particularly strong action hero. So it's all very quick cuts, short scenes. It's not quite as as balletic as maybe we might see in some other, even of Choi Hark's films. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's certainly, there are elements of this film, but at the same time, it's not the same as if you like, we're looking at like a John Woo or a Ringo Lam, that sort of style of action. It's very, it works within the context of this film, but in terms of like action cinema, I mean, it could seem as being a little, perhaps a little more sloppy. It's still enjoyable to watch. It's not to take anything away from it, but certainly this isn't a director working at his best for this particular aspect of the film.
No, I do feel it's a bit unlike, we could point at some of his other work, Zoo Warriors and Once Upon a Time in China series, and we can see he's more than capable of directing a more balletic kind of action, whereas this one is punchy, is quick, it's bang, bang, bang. It's almost Paul Greengrass, yeah, in some ways. But which I think it's just interesting. It just shows there's a flexibility to the guy. But it works in this film because it does not let up, yeah, from the opening scene until the very end, bit of a downer scene at the end. It's an exhausting nearly 2 hours, but thrilling all the way along.
Yeah, and even though it's like 2 hours, I mean, it does absolutely fly by, and I think the fact there's so much happening in this film, and that we got the constant switches in style, and it just only sort of adds to this this weird mixture that we have on. And I think, as you said, the ending is a bit of a downer. I mean, it could be seen as being a downer, especially as what we've been through to get to that point. But at the same, I don't know how I feel in the ending. I feel kind of mixed.
It is, because if you, so I guess the thing I didn't really mention is that this film is based in a, you know, if you know about your Chinese history and you know about your Peking opera, there's lots of things that maybe you and I are probably gonna miss out on because we're missing a lot of these visual cues. So there's a moment, for example, where it starts snowing, And apparently, that is a sign of luck. So I think it's Bridget Lynn and I think it's Cherry Chung. No, it's Sally Ye's character sort of connect at that point. It starts snowing. It's meant to show that it's an auspicious and lucky moment, and it's taken straight from a Peking opera. The whole thing, you know, people like the women dressed as men, is taken from stories like Hua Mulan and so on and so forth, which are common themes. So you and I probably missed that out. In terms of the Chinese history, this was a period of time where the monarchy, the Qing dynasty, has fallen. This is a country trying to find its feet in the world as a democracy. What's going to happen in about 15, 20 years' time is we're going to get Mao Zedong's communist revolution, and the country's going to change forever. So everything they've achieved in this film, the whole success, is actually going to fall apart. And we have the characters at the end saying, oh, we're going to go do this, I'm going to do that. They don't actually go off and do things together. And it's probably a sort of a meta criticism of China at the time. So it's, again, there's this depth to it, but it's, you know, it's kind of downbeat, and I'm kind of used to my Hong Kong movies of this time sort of just suddenly ending. You know, usually the final blow is struck, hurrah, we're done, and it goes to the end, and that's literally how these films tend to end. Whereas this one has this little kind of downbeat coda, and like I say, if you know your Chinese history and you know what's actually going to happen, it's kind of sad, but I like it about this film because I guess that's why it's got blues in the title.
That's true. Further watching, I mean, what would you want to pair this with? What would you say is be your companion piece to Peking Opera Blues?
Okay, so as usual, I'm going to pick a film from this director, Choi Hark. So I think I've said again and again, he's a major player in this era. So I could have gone for something like Zoo Warriors and the Magic Mountain. I could have gone for something in the Once Upon a Time in China series, although I think we'll probably talk about at least one of those films in a future podcast. He went off to America with John Woo and at least another of this era's... did Ringo Lam go across to America? I can't remember.
Yeah,
I think he did.
And Ringo Lam went to do those questionable Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. So
he did. Troy Hark also did a questionable Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. Basically, his time in America was not successful, which is a shame because in a way he should have been, you know, over in America in the late 90s, the highlight of action cinema. He should have been a huge success. It didn't work. He made a few films that are really fairly unsuccessful, like Missing and things like Time and Tide and All About Women, which have their fans, but they weren't up to this standard. And then in 2010 he made a film called Detective D and the Mystery of the Phantom Flame, and he pulls together people like Andy Lau and Big Tony Leung and creates this fantastic, it's very CGI based wuxia movie that's the most fun that you will have had with a Choi Hark movie since Once Upon a Time in China 5. It's a fabulous, glorious film. The sequel, well, actually it's a prequel, isn't a patch on it, but yes, absolutely, Detective D, The Mystery of the Phantom Flame, or if you had to, his remake of Flying Swords of Dragon Gate, both of them are fantastic modern Hong Kong wuxia movies.
Yeah, Detective D and The Mystery of the Phantom Flame. I was surprised about how much I actually really enjoyed this one. It's essentially Sherlock Holmes, if Sherlock Holmes knew Kung Fu. This film was also really interesting, the fact that it broke its own legs. What could have been essentially a fantastic little series of films, much like the Heroic Trio films, which did the same thing with its sequel Executioners. We essentially have an ending here which meant that we couldn't really go any further with the series, and unsurprisingly they found a way to work around it by doing the prequel with Young Detective D, which I've yet to see, but I'm kind of now a little more cautious after your criticism of it there, Stephen. But
well, it's fine if you like Mark Chow and Angela Baby, who that'll mean something to people who watch modern Chinese cinema. It's absolutely fine. Although, apparently next year he is making a new Detective D film, so I will be interested to see how that comes out.
Yeah. I mean, the character of Detective D, though, as a, if you like the recent Sherlock Holmes movies, this is essentially the same, just obviously with a Chinese setting and the fact that it's got added bonus of martial arts. But the character Detective D is absolutely fantastic, and there's some really great set scenes within the film as well. So it's definitely one that's worth checking out if you haven't done already.
Oh, absolutely. You've got Karina Lau, Li Bingbing, and Andy Lau, Tony Leung-Kar-Fai, as I say. And it's just a glorious thing, and more power to it.
Yeah. For myself, still staying on the theme of the Peking Opera, though, I'm going to go for the 1988 film Painted Faces, starring Sammo Hung and directed by Alex Law. Now, this is a film which is based in part on Sammo Hung's training with the Chinese opera. In particular, the training of the Seven Little Fortunes, which included not only Sammo Hung, but also Jackie Chan as well. And it focuses on the training that they had to go through, including some rather brutal disciplinary techniques. This film sees Sammo Hung playing his mentor, Master Yim Jin Yun, and it's a film which, for one reason or another, like many of the Sammo Hung movies, like Peking, like many of the Sammo Hung movies, it's just never had the distribution it really deserves. So you can get hold of it through various sources. It is available in perhaps more grainier cuts than a film of this quality certainly deserves, but especially seeing as it saw Hung winning his second Hong Kong Film Award for Best Actor at the 8th Hong Kong Film Awards. It's a really fantastic movie, even if it's a little difficult to watch in places, but certainly see Sammo Hung doing a more drama-driven role is always interesting to see, and here it's absolutely fantastic, and certainly well deserving of the praise he received for this film.
No, I'll definitely have to check that one out. I haven't seen that, and in fact, again, and to my shame, I haven't seen a lot of Sammo Hung's films, although he's been a key he was the action director on the Detective D film, funnily enough, to join it all together. But you know, I've been far more worthy of work either behind the scenes or as a guest star in certain films, so that I will try and track that one down and certainly give it a watch, because it sounds fascinating.
On our next episode, we are going to be looking at a film which has recently been picked up for an American remake, and it's going to be released through Netflix. So we're going to go back and look at the original Death Note. And this is going to be, I believe it's a first time watch for yourself, Stephen?
It absolutely is. I think I might have mentioned it in my cinema shame that I've never seen any of the Death Note movies. And as you say, it's coming to Netflix as an American remake. It's about time I sorted out so I understood what was going on, right?
Yeah, I mean, Death Note is one of those films which has really become a cultural phenomenon, whether you're looking at it through both the manga or the anime, or just the films themselves. They've really spawned this whole cult following, with the film obviously being followed by several sequels, the fourth, which is due to be released shortly, but we're obviously going to go back and look at the original 2006 live action version, obviously see get ourselves prepared for when the remake obviously does show up on Netflix, which is going to be very soon. I believe it's at the end of August.
Excellent. I better get my Death Note watching sorted out.
In the meantime, haven't done already, you can check out our back catalogue of episodes on thatmomentin.com, where we are obviously a proud member of the thatmomentin.com podcast network. Stephen, if people obviously want to find more of your work, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me at my own blog, although I haven't written very much very recently, at guelorambling.wordpress.com. You'll have far more luck finding my work and other excellent stuff on Asian cinema at easternkicks.com. And if you want to get hold of me on the Twitter, you can find me at LPVO.
Cool. And as for myself, not only am I doing more writing for thatmoaning.com, you can find my blog From the Depths of DVD Hell, both on Facebook, as well as fromthedepthsdvdhell.blogspot.co.uk. And I'm also on the Twitter, which is at Elwood_Jones. As I said, if you have a film that you would like to see us covered on a future episode, please do let us know in the comment section below. Full links, of course, are available there as well for not only our letterbox list, which contains all the films that we've covered on the show to date, as well as the links to our various pages as well. But as always, I'd like to say thank you to my co-host Stephen for joining me for another episode.
Pleasure as always.
And this is Edward Jones, signing off another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club.